This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books and Religion on the New Books Network. My name is Diana Dehanova, and I'll be your host today. And today I'm speaking with Mark Roscoe Lusto, an anthropologist and scholar of religion, studying religion and nationalism in Eastern Europe. He works at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, as managing editor of the Journal of Liberal Catholicism. And today we'll be discussing his new book, Hungarian Catholic Intellectuals in Contemporary Romania, Reforming Apostles. Mark, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Now, to start us off, could you talk a little bit about your research background and how you came to study this particular topic?
I was trained by anthropologists in a religious studies department after I had completed a theology degree at Harvard Divinity School. So in my research and publishing, I wear a lot of hats and participate in multiple conversations and dialogues. All three disciplines I find stimulating, and they really help me understand life, culture, and religion and nationalism from different perspectives. I was raised Unitarian religiously in a suburb of New York City, and the church was a member of the American Unitarian Church. And there is an indigenous Transylvanian Hungarian Unitarian Church, which actually helped me in my field work because I could introduce myself as a Unitarian, and that category made sense to many of the Catholics in Romania's Chuuk Valley, which was where I was based while I was doing ethnographic field work. My first visit to Transylvania, a region of Romania, was in 2005 to do archival research in the headquarters of Transylvania's indigenous Hungarian Unitarian Church. And then in 2008, I learned about the Catholic tradition in Romania's Transylvania region and the Chuuk Valley, and then also a major pilgrimage site and shrine called Csíkszomjó. I learned about these things for the first time from a devout Hungarian Catholic family that went every year to that pilgrimage site. And so that was really the first time that I was introduced to the Catholic tradition in that region.
That's really interesting. I don't want to get too far ahead, but you say that introducing yourself as a Unitarian kind of made sense to the people you talked to. So you feel like they sort of wanted to understand where you were based spiritually in terms of where your questions were coming from?
Partly, yeah. This is leaping ahead a little bit to a section of my book that actually I put at the very end of the book in an epilogue where I talk about what it was like to do field work with Catholics and to engage with them in the process of their prayer practices. Although they knew that I was a Unitarian, they were very open about inviting me to join them in various different worship practices and prayer practices, and to the extent that I could, and to the extent that was appropriate theologically and ritually, I participated. Within the spirit of ethnographic participant observation. But we can talk, in the epilogue, I talk a lot more about, in specifics, what the experience of praying with Catholics in Transylvania, what that was like for me, and what kind of effect it had on me and my embodied habitus in the world. But that's kind of leaping ahead to one of your later questions, I suspect.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thought that was an interesting part of the experience. Before we get too far ahead, for listeners who might be unfamiliar, could you talk a little bit about the history of Hungarian Transylvania and Transylvanian identity and kind of what that means?
So Transylvania, when I first found out about it, as a contested region in Europe. So it's currently within the borders of Romania, and it has hosted a long tradition also of religious diversity, and it's been contested by various different religious and political groups for centuries, for a very long time. And it's also that history of contestation is really one of the reasons why I found doing research there to be so interesting. It's before World War I, Transylvania belonged to Hungary when it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And that's partly why there is a sizable ethnic Hungarian minority currently living in Transylvania. There are, by some counts, 1.5 million ethnic Hungarians in Romania, and they variously belong to the Reformed Protestant, Unitarian, and Catholic churches, living alongside Romanians who, by and large, belong to the Orthodox Church as well as a branch of the Catholic Church called the Greek Catholic Church or an Eastern Rite Church. This is, again, not even to mention the growing number of charismatic and Pentecostal believers in the region, as well as the historical Jewish community in many Transylvanian cities, and so on and so forth. I could go on with the list. There was also a significant German-speaking Saxon community in many areas of Transylvania until 1989, in the early 1990s. So really my research focusing, I didn't quite deal with all those other communities. My research in particular focused on how Hungarian educators in the ethnic Hungarian minority in Transylvania created a new sense of ethnic minority and identity and purpose as teachers after Transylvania became part of Romania. The Romanian government, this was in the post-World War I era, when the Romanian government really took control of the region's educational system and schools, and many ethnic Hungarian teachers lost their jobs in these institutions. And I focused specifically on Catholic educators' role in the process of rediscovering a purpose and sense of mission in serving the Hungarian ethnic minority in Transylvania.
Yeah, it's quite a fascinating region. I was able to go, this was almost 20 years ago now, but I studied abroad in Eastern Europe. So that was something that part of Hungary that they brought us to. And we were able to stay in some rural villages, in fact, and really experience that aspect of day-to-day life there as well.
You've been to Transylvania?
Yeah, and it's fascinating how so many people that you meet, speak 5-6 languages.
Yes.
Just because of the nature life in that part of the
country. Yes, the older generation was taught Russian in many schools, and younger generations, of course, speak English as far as, German as well as other languages. So it's a very kind of ethnically polyglot region.
Yeah, we were able to stay with a family who, you know, the father spoke German, the mother spoke Polish, then they both spoke Hungarian and Romanian, and they had made some agreement about what they were going to speak with the children. So it's, it's a very, very rich linguistically and culturally. So in terms of your study, how would you sort of situate it in terms of the existing body of scholarship on religion in this region?
So certainly as Michael Hertzfeldt, who is a mentor of mine, wrote in his perhaps really kind of overly generous and overly kind blurb to my book, he said that, you know, one of the goals of the book is to start us down the path to humanizing, and us meaning anthropologists, down the path to humanizing an intellectual discipline and group, theologians, that was long treated with suspicion in the discipline of anthropology. Certainly that humanizing process is one of the goals that I set out for myself in the book. But I also couldn't help but engage with the burgeoning political scientific literature about Christian, especially about Christian nationalism and populism, since political science departments tend to dominate the professional knowledge about this region, about Eastern Europe as a whole, which is actually a point that I take from Rogers Brubaker, who's kind of one of the most famous nationalism studies scholars currently working. Back in 1998, Brubaker once complained that the robust demand for knowledge about nationalism in the wake of the collapse of socialism and the resurgence of national politics in the 1990s, that this robust demand was fueling what he called, quote, an analytically primitive current in the study of nationalism, end quote. So 22 years later, we could perhaps say the same thing about recent research on Christian nationalism in Eastern Europe, which, and this was an argument that I make in the book, which suffers, I think, from an unacknowledged moral bias when scholars speak about Christianity, and specifically when political scientists refer to Christianity being hijacked, nationalized, or culturalized by politicians. And I think that characterization, which is really more of a caricature, really more accurately describes the Christianity that political scientists want to see in the region rather than an objective attempt to understand current trends in political culture. So what I try to do to kind of at least break open and complicate that, I think, somewhat again, caricatured view of Christianity and nationalism, I try to understand the actual practice of Catholic theologians' involvement in a populist movement as a form of creative religious agency. Really a creative religious agency that takes shape within broader fields of post-socialist culture and specifically post-socialist consumer culture. So I see today's Transylvanian Catholic educators trying to sustain and even readapt an experience of laboring alongside God. This is one of their basic concepts, laboring alongside God that they inherited from their predecessors in the interwar period. And they do so by trying to teach secular urbanites from Hungary who come to Transylvania to donate their time and their resources to help Transylvanian Hungarian schools. They try to teach secular urbanites how to experience God working with them in these charitable projects.
Mm-hmm. It's such an interesting and very complex intersection between political science and anthropology and religious studies. It's something I see in my own work because I study religion in Russia and Ukraine, and just the kind of absolute mess that's been made of the reporting, especially in the mainstream press, about what is going on in Ukraine religiously and in wider Eastern Europe and in post-socialist countries, I think has been painful to watch for, you know, everyone who studies that region.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly there's a lot of, I read this a lot in the political science literature, a lot of anxiety about how journalists write about political culture and government and religion as well, and a lot of anxiety about whether that's having an influence on political scientists and their approach to current trends in this region. You know, there's a lot of there are occasionally complaints about, you know, journalistic style or journalistic interpretations of political phenomena in Eastern Europe, and that's always that seems always to be said from a very pejorative perspective, as if we need to draw a complete, you know, boundary line between these between journalists and scholars.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish that maybe there were more avenues for productive dialogue, right, between the two groups. So could you talk a little bit more about your fieldwork experience and how you decided where particularly you were going to do it and who your research subjects were going to be?
Yeah, you know, I tried to approach fieldwork from kind of a holistic and intuitive methodological perspective. You know, I very rarely felt like I was selecting research subjects or choosing who to interview or, you know, seeking out particular individuals who had particularly influential roles in various different institutions. You know, just to give you an example of kind of how I ended up studying one of the institutions that ended up being the focus of a chapter of an entire chapter of my book. So this is chapter three on composure. It's chapter four called Composure, which is really about a volunteer choir that sings in one of the largest Catholic churches in Transylvania, a very famous Catholic church. And I heard about the volunteer choir because I ended up renting a room from a member of the alto section when I first got to Transylvania. I answered an ad, rented her room, and then she told me about this choir, and that's how I ended up. She gave me the phone number of the choir director, and literally his only question to me when I asked if I could, you know, sing with a choir was, "Can you sing?" And I said yes, and I suddenly was a member of the choir. So, and that's how, you know, one entire chapter of my book, that was the, you know, that's how it got started. So there was a lot of kind of accidentalness about choosing research subjects or just, you know, finding my way into the context that ended up being at the heart of my book empirically. Which is also to say that when I think back on my ethnography, that the ethnography that felt the richest to me was the moments when I wasn't really doing formal or even semi-formal interviews, but when I was really participating and observing at the same time, more kind of improvised and indirectly coordinated interactions. When people, you know, to put it a little bit more informally, when people were just hanging out and chatting with each other. At one of the, in chapter three of the book, I talk about a week-long volunteer construction project, sort of like what folks in North America and the United States might know of as kind of a Habitat for Humanity project. It was sort of like that. We were helping to repair a building at a Catholic orphanage, and the group was primarily volunteer visitors from Hungary, from urban Hungary. During the kind of week-long construction project, of course, you know, I paid attention to the priests and what they said during their sermons and kind of the more formal statements about how we were supposed to be interpreting our work together that week. But I also wrote in this chapter, I wrote about a former orphan who had kind of graduated. He was now in his early 20s. He'd graduated and lived in that orphanage. He was now living nearby in the area. And during the construction project, he kind of led volunteers, including me, to a nearby public fountain to fill the water bottles because it was hot and dusty in August, and we were digging a lot. And kind of near the fountain, there was a swimming hole, and on a couple of occasions, he invited me and some other folks to go swimming with him to kind of take some of the heat off and to cool ourselves down. And, you know, this very somewhat spontaneous, very informal, improvised set of interactions ended up, being one of the kind of core vignettes in this chapter of my book. And I mined it for some significant kind of cultural insight into the social dynamics, especially between orphans and the institutions and the leaders of these educational institutions I minded for some insight into the social dynamics between those figures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was one of my favorite parts of the book, and just in general, sort of the way that you wove together the research and the experiential element of the study was really interesting.
You know, it was... I especially liked it also because it felt like a very, and I think this was, intuitively intentional, if that's not a contradiction in terms, an intuitively intentional choice on the part of the young man who led us to on those swimming excursions. It created a sense of intimacy amongst us, who were there kind of resting alongside the swimming hole. But it was also interesting because it, directly recreated some of the stories basically that were kind of advertisements, by the director of the orphanage, who was a very famous Catholic priest named Chuba Boita, who himself talks in kind of public statements and advertisements about how he really likes taking Hungarian volunteers on swimming excursions. And that's a real highlight for him about volunteer projects in Transylvania. So, on the one hand, you could say that the young man who in the book I call Ombrus, which is a pseudonym, on the one hand, Ombrus was basically recreating and even mimicking what the director of the orphanage was telling him to do, to cater to the expectations and interests basically of visiting Hungarian volunteers. And on the other hand, and this was something that I had to kind of unpack out of an understanding of Ombrus's position and role in Transylvania Hungarian culture itself, he was from a different region and was facing really demands, suggestions that he go back to the village where he was born, even though he hadn't lived there since he was a very young child. He was facing suggestions constantly to go back to that village and settle there and take up his life there. And he didn't want to. He said on a couple of occasions that he was not interested in going back to that village because he hadn't been there since he was a child and he didn't really know anybody there. So here he was kind of making a claim to local knowledge of these hidden swimming holes and the kind of almost secret rules about how to use these swimming holes, how to find them, who should go there. He was making a claim to knowing the region around the orphanage where he had grown up, over and against these demands that he return back to his natal village, which was quite a distance away. So there was a lot going on in these kind of very, even a significant political dimension, you could even say, to what felt like, very intuitive and even improvised decisions to go swimming on a hot day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's certainly not the kind of thing that you can find in the archives, right? You really need to build these relationships. So one of the key premises of your book, just to get back a little bit to terminology, is that theologians ought to be understood and studied as intellectuals. That's a quote. So how would you define an intellectual? And how is the intellectual and social work of theologians usually framed?
So it's a great question. I don't actually give a definition of the intellectual in my book, so you're sort of kind of calling me out a little bit. But actually, I appreciate it because it gives me a chance to say exactly why I didn't. And it was an intentional choice on my part. And it had two specific reasons. There were two specific reasons for not giving a definition of the intellectual. The first was partly strategic. Because so often, I feel like scholars end up bickering about a definition instead of deeply and thoughtfully engaging with a book's argument. And so in the end, you know, whether it's the reviews or debates afterwards or articles that are published and engaging with a book or whatever, it always ends up becoming about the definition rather than about the overall arc and narrative of the book itself.
That's fair. That's fair.
So it was partly strategic, but then there was also an element of principle, and this is sort of out of respect for one of the writers who really had a strong influence on the course of the book, which was Zygmunt Bauman's observation. So Zygmunt Bauman was a historian and sociologist who has written a lot about Eastern Europe, and he observed, and I quote this in the book, that any knowledge about intellectuals is inevitably relational and dialogical and this is not a quotation because this is my rather elliptic interpretation of what he said, that knowledge by intellectuals, for intellectuals, about intellectuals is always going to involve somehow intellectuals looking at themselves because there's a reflexive element to any kind of research about intellectuals. To attempt a definition of what the intellectual is would feel like a refusal, I guess, of that kind of essential relational matrix, an attempt to halt the give and take of dialogue between really a community of anthropological intellectuals who are studying intellectuals and their relationships with Transylvanian, Hungarian intellectuals themselves. So I didn't want to give a definition because they also have this kind of, definitions have this pretension to being universalistic, not only in time, but also in space. So you could say that, a definition is supposed to be applicable in all human societies and throughout all time. And that just seemed like a way of stopping the conversation between me and Transylvanian Hungarian intellectuals rather than opening it up. So I wanted folks to try to puzzle out for themselves from the actual lived experience that I represented in the book, what it's like to be an educator in the Transylvanian Hungarian community today. So that was sort of the more principled goal. But okay, having said all of those caveats, I'm not going to be completely intransigent about this. So I do like how Zygmunt Bauman, in his book, the title of his book is Legislators and Interpreters. So he doesn't really define intellectuals so much as he kind of tells us what they do and what kinds of objects they are distinctively concerned with. So, legislators write laws, and he's there pointing to the historical period when intellectuals were embedded in the state. And then interpreters, he thinks of as interpreting cultural meanings. And that is his kind of thesis that, the nation state is, he was writing in the 1990s and 2000s, and he saw the nation state kind of declining in significance and the growth of transnational cultural flows. And so, intellectuals' primary objects there were was kind of free-flowing cultures, and their work was interpretation. And Now, I kind of disagree with that latter specific finding. I think, you know, the optimistic view of the declining significance of the nation state has not borne out exactly as he predicted in history. But I would say, just kind of following his approach, which I found inspiring, I would say that, I would call theologians reformers, right? In the sense of re-forming ethical subjects. In the Transylvanian Hungarian intellectual tradition, which was strongly influenced by Protestantism, the idea of reforming Christian apostles, the early Christian intellectuals, in the, second and third century, that was a really dominant goal. And so if I had to, characterize, theologians and what their objects are and what their work is about, as I would say, kind of capturing it in this phrase, reforming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. And I actually really like the sort of resistance to a definition, because I think we also spend a lot of time in the study of religion around defining what is and is not a religion. And I think sometimes it can be actually, as you said, sort of halting of dialogue. So could you talk a little bit more about the cultural and intellectual tradition of Hungarian Transylvania vis-a-vis Hungary, and what are some of the distinctive features?
So certainly, in Hungary, as in Transylvania, religious intellectuals are defined by a Catholic and Protestant divide and dialogue. In Hungary, at least in the interwar period, the key symbols that differentiated Catholics from Protestants concerned the nature and character of the Hungarian state. So for Catholics, King Stephen's crown, which is actually the image that's on the front cover of my book, blurred and obscured, but still kind of recognizable as King Stephen's crown, that image evokes notions of empire and monarchy, and it's kind of strongly associated with Catholicism. Protestants, in contrast, looked to the 1848 revolution, led by members of the Reformed Church, and they kind of, by remembering those figures, center Hungary's republican tradition of governance. Now, the question of the state, I argue, was marginal to the Transylvanian-Hungarian intellectual tradition in its interwar incarnation, when it really began, because the tradition was itself a response to the disappearance of the Hungarian state from Transylvanian-Hungarian intellectual life after World War I. They were trying to really figure out how to have an intellectual tradition in the absence of a state. Transylvanian-Hungarian Reformed Protestant theologians broke new ground in the interwar period by coming up with a notion of vocational authority, this internal sense of being called to teach that, was really a lot like a conversion, an internal sense of being called to teach that was really exemplified by the early Christian apostles before the Catholic Church became allied with the power of the Roman Empire. So they, really had this sense of, okay, well, if we're going to have a non-state-centered notion of pedagogical authority, let's look to the Christians who did not depend on any state to do their work. And they thought that this was best exemplified by the pre-Roman Empire, pre-Catholic Church period of the early Christian apostles. Interwar Catholics were not only late to the game of kind of reimagining pedagogical authority in the absence of a state, but they faced the challenge of overcoming their church's deep antagonism towards Reformed Protestants, who at this time in the 20s and 30s, the Pope was still calling infidels and apostates. So, it was a challenge for them to try to be in dialogue with Protestants, Reformed Protestants, especially because, the leader of their church was saying, how dare you? Don't you even dare, rather. So to get on board with the project of crafting, you know, an ethnic minority intellectual tradition that rested on this notion of intellectual authority outside the state, Transylvanian Hungarian Catholics really had to figure out how to overcome this historical antipathy, how to find ways to embrace the agenda of reforming institutions by looking to the early Christian apostles. And they had to do this without raising alarms about abandoning their faith for Protestantism. It was, you know, a delicate high wire act involving lots of contradictions and, you know, attempts at resolving those contradictions that were never, you know, fully and finally resolved that, you know, I try to kind of trace in my book.
Mm-hmm. And what is the contemporary relationship between the Transylvanian Hungarian volunteer teachers and the state?
Well, in many ways, the volunteers from Hungary who go and kind of donate their time charitably to Transylvanian Hungarian educational institutions are in many ways representatives of the state. So they, you know, there is a strong sense that when Transylvanian Hungarian teachers are interacting with these volunteers, that what's at stake is, you know, the ongoing support of the Hungarian state for Transylvanian Hungarian intellectuals and the educational system. So there's clearly a lot at stake in dealing with volunteers. But my book itself begins with kind of the most famous contemporary Transylvanian Hungarian educator, who's a Catholic priest and Franciscan friar named Csaba Bojta, who I've already mentioned. I start with him standing on the steps of the Hungarian Parliament building in Budapest, accepting an award from the newly elected right-wing Hungarian government, which has since gone on to, you know, become very famous for being strongly nationalistic and populist. And Viktor Orban is, you know, almost daily in the English language international news.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of people know who we're talking about when I mention this. So, you know, this priest, Csaba Bojta, is standing on the steps of the Hungarian Parliament building, accepting an award from Orbán's new government. So really, the relationship between the Hungarian state and Transylvanian Hungarian intellectuals is at the heart of my book. And that's really what I tried to convey by putting that scene, you know, at the very beginning. And it's also a departure from previous research on Transylvanian Hungarian intellectuals, which presented their work really within the matrix of state sovereignty and the contest between the Romanian and Hungarian states over control of Transylvania. So here I wanted to foreground the relationship between Transylvanian Hungarian intellectuals and the Hungarian state, as a way to kind of question exactly how straightforwardly we might understand that relationship. So when it comes to relations with the Romanian state, Transylvanian Hungarian educators generally kind of see it as antagonistic and they're very suspicious of it. And that's, you know, they've inherited that from really from the interwar period when the folks who originated the Transylvanian Hungarian intellectual tradition were kind of, they had gotten fired from the educational institutions that they worked at by the Romanian state. So they were born into this tradition or revived this tradition and inherited from it a sense of suspicion towards the Romanian state. But the relationship with the Hungarian state is another matter entirely, and it's filled with many more ambiguous gestures, and it's deeply unstable, even if it might appear on the surface to be very straightforward, a matter of kind of a client-patron bond, clients being the Transylvanian Hungarian educators and the patron being the state. You know, it's filled with quiet gestures and indirect implications that convey kind of ambiguous identifications and gratitudes, stifled resentments, confusions, ironic humor, anxiety, lots of redirected critique. There's all sorts of subtle messaging that goes on when Transylvanian Hungarian educators encounter the Hungarian state. So one of my favorite examples of this is from my fieldwork with the Catholic Church choir that I've mentioned. Like other educators, they pictured themselves teaching the people, which they generally understood as peasants, villagers, and in this case, they were teaching them how to worship properly. And as a reward for their volunteer service, the Catholic Church worked with the Hungarian government to organize a vacation. I was part of this group, and we went on a singing tour of various cities in Hungary. And inviting us onto this tour, we got a letter from Hungary's Christian, an official in Hungary's Christian Democratic People's Party, which is the right-wing Christian partner to the current Fidesz party that governs Hungary. And they've been partners together in governing Hungary now for the last 12 years, since 2010. And in the letter, this kind of politician, this official, called the choir a shining accomplishment of Hungary's Christian culture that had achieved a European level of fame. And immediately upon reading, when the choir director read this sentence out loud, the entire choir just burst out into laughter. And it became a recurring joke where people would, say, oh, we're a European level famous choir, aren't we? And everybody would laugh. And it was just, recurring joke that never failed to bring a smile to the choir member's face. And in the end, I interpret this joke kind of as expressing a deeper anxiety about how the Hungarian government was really appropriating the work of Transylvanian Hungarian educators for its own purposes, that is, showing off on the European stage, its own, accomplishments in creating and fostering a Christian culture. For various different reasons, Transylvanian Hungarian volunteer educators, they didn't feel capable of disputing this, reinterpretation, this appropriation of their work openly. They were, after all, kind of clients of this patron state, but they could laugh about how the government was overbilling their skills. these were basically lawyers and housewives and retirees and teachers and bureaucrats and secretaries, and they were singing in a choir in their free time. Right. And so, they could joke about how the state was overbilling their skills when they couldn't, openly refuse this effort to appropriate their project for other goals and means.
Well, that's fascinating. There's a whole genre, in Russian and Ukrainian of jokes about these kinds of relationships, at least during communism, between the government and various groups, and sort of on the one hand rejecting the West, and on the other hand showing how important they were in the West. Right. So it seems resonant of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The chapters of your book are named after the key precepts that guide the educational work of the Hungarian Catholic intellectuals. So could you talk a little bit about those?
Certainly. So my chapter titles are single word terms, and this was my desire for brevity, being manifested here. Always say less especially when it's possible to say more. And so the single word terms are love, composure, courtliness, and penitence. And these are the virtues that were exemplified by each of the groups in which I did my field work, an orphanage network, the choir that I've mentioned, a knighthood order, and then another orphanage network, which kind of concludes the ethnographic elements of my book. Together, they represent a suite of ethical values that I believe kind of helped constitute or was basically the ethnic minority intellectual culture, or what I call the Transylvanian Hungarian intellectual tradition. And they inherited these virtues, and here I was drawing on really excellent intellectual historical work by scholars like Stefano Bottoni and Nando Arbardi, who have written about, and also Bolaž Trečeni, who have written about the interwar period, especially, and kind of the ethical worldview of Hungarian intellectuals in the interwar period. So I was really drawing a lot on what they had to write about the 1920s and 30s.
Mm-hmm. So I think you touched on this just a little bit earlier. Could you talk a little bit more about the impact of socialist era educational practice on contemporary education?
Yeah, so in the 1980s was a period, and that's really that was the direct historical context, the 1980s was the direct historical background that Transylvanian Hungarian educators were looking to when they started their work in the 1990s and 2000s. The 1980s was a period of robust nationalism, you might call it, in the Romanian educational system especially. And this raised a lot of anxieties among Transylvanian Hungarians about cultural assimilation. And then these anxieties really informed and set the stage for Transylvanian Hungarian intellectuals in the 1990s to draw comparisons between the interwar period and the post-socialist period, both eras in which, at least from the perspective of ethnic minority intellectuals, the Romanian state was using education to nationalize Transylvania's Hungarian population. In the process, ethnic minority intellectuals kind of revived the intellectual tradition that that had originated in the interwar period and had originated to deal with what they saw as a similar set of circumstances. So in the end, I'm agnostic in the book about whether this comparison is accurate. That's not really a question that I wanted to answer or felt qualified to answer, but I was more interested in the kinds of consequences, the social consequences that flowed from this comparison, this analogy, and the decision to revive the interwar tradition of intellectualism and the kind of problems that it created, but also the opportunities that it created for intellectuals in the post-socialist period.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to circle back to something we touched on in the beginning. So in your conclusion, you call an anthropologist of Christianity to write for Christian publications. So could you talk a little bit about your work in this area and the value that you see anthropologists bringing to publications like that?
Yeah, so, it is a complicated question for many anthropologists about how to... it's always been complicated, no matter what kind of identification we're talking about, for anthropologists to suss out and to explore and figure out exactly how their various different identities impact upon or shape their relationships with subjects in the field. And it's become even more complicated, I think, now that anthropologists, a great number of them, have decided to study Christian communities in particular. In one section of the book, my conclusion, I talk about some of my experience doing public scholarship by publishing opinion articles, harshly critical of Hungary's right-wing government, in Christian magazines, and how that affected and reshaped some of the relationships that I had with folks who I met in Transylvania. But just as important, I think, to understanding my relationships with the folks that I met in Transylvania, the Catholics and Unitarians and Protestants who were part of the Transylvanian Hungarian community, just as important, I think, was the prayer practices that I took up while I was doing fieldwork. And I mentioned this a little bit at the beginning of the interview. And I suspect that you began the interview with a question about how I came to study this topic, because it's a good warm-up. You know, it's something of an easy question to answer. So I'm probably not the first person or the last person you'll ask that question to at the start of the interview. So you know, there is, I think, at least in anthropology, a formula for answering this question. And it's a pretty set standard and for that reason, easy formula. And Informin asks the anthropologist, and I kind of recreated it in that first answer, in the first part of our conversation. And Informin asks the anthropologist about ethnic and religious identity. Then step two, the anthropologist responds and makes sense according to the informant's categories. And then step three, there are a few complications. Step four, but these don't prevent the anthropologist from fitting in, making friends, and eventually conducting a successful research project. End of formula, end of paragraph. And that's generally, you'll find that exact paragraph at the beginning of many books in the introduction. It's usually just about a paragraph. At the beginning of many anthropological monographs. So anthropologists seem to have settled on this formula in the wake of what was called the self-reflexive turn of the 1980s and 90s, when social scientists, often using kind of a loosely autobiographical writing style, critically examined their relationships with the people that they got to know at their field sites, as well as the historical and social forces that kind of gave particular shape to these relationships and friendships and various different other types of relationships and interactions that they had in the field, mentorships as well. So the formula now is as close as anthropologists get to kind of a reflexive examination of our relationships with subjects, and especially in the anthropology of religion. In the epilogue to my book, I try to develop a claim that although anthropologists have settled on this formula, its continuing use represents what I think of as intellectual complacency, especially in the wake of anthropologists' really detailed and really rich and theoretically robust examinations of Christian traditions. Especially Christian traditions that seek to convert and otherwise transform their adherents' worldviews. So this encounter with a transformation-seeking tradition, to my mind, called to mind the anthropologist Michael Taussig's insistence that fieldwork always changes you, always changes anthropologists in some fundamental way. Taussig, in one of his books, basically kind of sums up the anthropological project by saying that the great story in anthropology, and this is a quote, is how such a change is dealt with, how such a change that the anthropologist experiences is dealt with, whether it is recognized, and how it is acted upon in the rest of the anthropologist's life until death. And then the other thing, and then end quote, the other thing that drew me to Taussig, and I reflect on him a lot in the epilogue, was the leitmotif of whimsy and playfulness that runs throughout his work. That's one of his kind of hallmarks, is that he has a very elliptical writing style. He doesn't strive. He almost strives for the opposite of linearity. He's a very creative and playful and even, frustrating writer if you're expecting a straightforward argument in any of his books. This whimsy and playfulness was very compelling to me, primarily, as an alternative to what I felt like was a very dominant way of understanding the relationship between an anthropologist and Christian subjects whom the anthropologist will meet in the field. And this alternative, the book that I had in mind as, before thinking about Taussig, was a book by Susan Friend Harding, very famously conducted fieldwork in the early 1990s with American evangelical Protestants in Virginia. The book is called The Book of Jerry Falwell, Fundamentalist Language and Politics. And for many years, have you ever heard of it? Yeah, it's very famous. And for many years, it was one of the only extended reflections on the particular problems posed by doing ethnographic fieldwork as an anthropologist in a community that makes conversion a primary objective and goal. Except that Harding talks about kind of getting her worldview violently displaced in the face of the evangelical efforts of her subjects. And she really dives deeply into one of the more fearful and anxious modes of engagement that historically the secular enlightenment in the West has adopted towards evangelical Protestant Christians who are out to, you know, who make conversion a central mode of their being in the world. And Harding's kind of really anxious imaginary just didn't line up with my experience of feeling like the Catholic women who invited me to join, especially their rosary prayer groups, were playing tricks on me, using their voices. And this is a quote that I draw directly from my field notes, my diary, using their voices like ventriloquists, casting their voices around the room while they were praying the rosary, which is a prayer practice centered on the recitation of a joint recitation of a single rote memorized text. So I went, you know, inspired by this observation that I read and that I wrote and then read later on in my own diary about ventriloquism and kind of playfulness, I went in search of an anthropological, a disciplinary trajectory that could help me understand, you know, this whimsy that I seemed compelled to attribute to the women in my prayer group. The whimsy that it seemed they were embodying even as they sought to convert me to Catholicism, which was, you know, very different from the kind of anxious menace that Susan Friend Harding seemed to find in her encounters with evangelical Protestants. And that's what started me down the path to Taussig's work.
So I'm afraid I have another standard question to wrap up with.
<That's okay. laughs>
I just wanted to ask you to talk about your current research, or if there's anything else that you'd like people to know about what you're working on now.
Certainly. So if this book was primarily about Transylvanian Hungarians and their relationships with Hungarians from Hungary and the Hungarian state, I'm kind of reversing the perspective in my next book and talking about Hungarians from Hungary who traveled to Transylvania and how they sustain a connection with the agenda of the right-wing Hungarian state, despite the various different problems that they encounter when they try to embody this in relationships with Transylvanian Hungarians in Transylvania. So I'm going from Transylvanian Hungarians to now looking at Hungarians from Hungary and how they are participating in Hungarian political culture, especially by going on tourist trips and charitable excursions to Transylvania. One of the premises of this book is to try to complicate a little bit portrayals of political culture in contemporary Eastern Europe, which is, there's been an explosion of interest in populism and extremist right-wing nationalism. And I wanted to try to understand how a group that you might call the center-right relate to extremism, how they manage to tolerate its presence among them at events in Transylvania, because a lot of center-right Hungarians go to Transylvania where they meet folks who are, you know, basically who like listening to heavy metal and who enjoy what you might call, you know, breaking taboos, and, you know, center-right folks breaking political taboos, behavioral taboos, getting into, taking chances by getting into somewhat confrontational interactions with Romanian authorities while they're in Transylvania. And center-right folks, this makes them very uncomfortable. So my interest is in trying to, you know, differentiate the center right from the extreme right, which has sort of become lumped together in research on political culture recently, and to try to understand the processes of distinction and differentiation that help center right folks feel like they're not quite on board with the agenda of extremists.
That's really interesting. Well, I'll look forward to reading that when it comes out. So I've been speaking with Mark Roscoe-Lusto, author of Hungarian Catholic Intellectuals and Contemporary Romania, Reforming Apostles, and that is available now from Palgrave Macmillan. Mark, thank you so much again for joining me today.
Thank you.